surprising. We're moving into the 70s now. Actually, we're moving back from the future. Todd obviously took us into a whole new era. I hope you enjoyed him. Certainly, he is at the cutting edge of the newest technology and some of the newest compositional ideas. What I played for you to begin with was a band that I play with in California called the Repercussion Unit. This was a tune written in the 70s called The Grand Ambulation of the B-Flat Zombies. And I think one of the things that illustrates very clearly is something that started happening really strongly in the 70s, and that's the influence of many, many, many kinds of influence coming into contemporary music, not anymore just Western classical, but jazz, rock and roll, East Indian, South Indian, African, all sorts of different influences. I thought the first thing we should do, however, is go over the listening for this week, because it's a rather complex tape. This tape was more or less designed by Jeff, so if you don't like it, blame him, not me. So if you want to get out your listening guide, we'll go over it a little bit. This tape was designed also very much like tape number two, not to so much illustrate a single point, but to show you the incredible amount of diversity that was happening. And I think you'll find the variety on this tape rather startling. And quite wonderful, actually. The first piece is by a composer named John Zorn, who I played at the very, very first class. If you remember, I played a piece called The Big Gun Down, which was based on Italian westerns. Remember the screaming and the horses and everything? Well, John Zorn is a composer in his mid to late 30s who's, again, like many of these composers, sort of defies categories. His music is often sold under classical music, but he very often plays in clubs that generally present jazz or rock and roll. And like many people since Lamont Young, one of the things he's done is pretty much always had his own band of musicians that are extremely good at changing channels very quickly between one style and another style, and his music is very much a kind of collage. This particular piece is called Spillane, and it's based on Mickey Spillane, the person who wrote the mysteries, the Mike Hammer mysteries, and it's sort of attempting to get into a quasi-sleazy world of the detective in what was it, the 30s that Spillane was? I thought it might be interesting first just to read you a short quote, because I think this sums up very much what the young composer was feeling in the 70s, and I think it's very much like what Todd would have said, although Todd would have said it a little bit more politely. I will edit it slightly, though. This is something I react strongly against, the idea of high art and low art. I mean, that distinction's a bunch of bullshit. That's the kind of thing created to make it look like you listen to classical music while you're sipping champagne, and with rock music you're booging with a bottle of beer, and jazz, you're in some dirty club with a shot of whiskey or something like that. That's a bunch of bullshit. There's good music and great music and phony music in every genre, and all the genres are the same. Classical music is no better than the blues because this guy went to school and got a degree and studied very cleanly while the other guy was out living it in the streets. This attitude I've been fighting against. People who grew up in the 60s listening to blues, rock, classical, avant-garde, ethnic music, I think we all share a common belief that all this music is on equal ground, and there's no art that's high art and low art. Pop music has musicians creating lasting works of art, and also schlock, and it's going to be thrown away the next day, and the same thing is true of the classical world. There's an incredible amount of bullshit being written. So this kind of equality of all kinds of music that comes in the, really by about the mid-70s, is very, very typical of John Zorn, and probably he's the most popular of the composers right now who's working with this kind of idea. He's a college dropout. He became a very, very good jazz saxophone player, and as I say, is one of those composers who's extremely comfortable in many different kinds of styles. This is his second album. It comes from, I think the date is wrong. I think it's 1988. The guide here says 86. I read the other day in an interview with him, it was 88. The first album was The Big Gun Down, which is what I played for you. The second example, you've heard something of his before. His name is Paul Lansky, and he's in his late 40s, and he's the head of the music department at Princeton, and he's extremely into technological transformations with computers of live sounds into digital sounds. And this is a piece of his where he takes a reading and he records it digitally rather, and then transforms all the sounds that you're hearing and creates the music simply from the words. Next, Laurie Anderson. Oh yes, Laurie Anderson comes from a tradition which we now call performance art. It really evolves from the kinds of things we were talking about in the 60s with the post-Cage idea of, instead of a performance simply being music or theater, it's this kind of combination where she shows videos, she does movement, she sings, she creates her own music, etc. And you can't really call it any one thing, and so the categories become performance art. It evolved really in the 60s, especially with people like Meredith Monk, who, if we have a little time later, we'll talk about. Laurie Anderson's an interesting one because this tune, Oh Superman, which we chose for you, actually became the number one bestseller in Europe for, actually 3 or 4 months, about 6, 7 years ago. She hasn't had the kind of success in this country she has in Europe, which is typical of many Americans, but she's another composer who's really transcended categories and has a new kind of audience that doesn't typically necessarily just go to classical concerts. The next one is David Hikes, which I know some of you have heard in sections. David Hikes, how to explain David Hikes. Remember a long time ago I talked about vowel formats and isolating vowels and how if you sort of really concentrated on the overtones of vowels, you could get different secondary sounds coming out? Well, all he does is sing using this technique. And his group has spent, again, it's a group that's been together for quite a long time. And what they do is concentrate on these kind of extended vocal techniques of isolating various vowel sounds, overtones of vowels, and they create music out of that. Anthony Braxton. Again, most of these people fall into cracks, and it's really hard to define them. Anthony Braxton is an Afro-American musician generally associated with jazz in terms of public performance, but he's always been a professor of composition, first at Mills and out Wesleyan. And his music, again, is one of those musics which you can't really say exactly what it is. It certainly has tremendous amount of jazz influences in it, but it also transcends, I think, what you would consider normally to be called jazz. The next composer is me. This piece was called for Morton Feldman. Morton Feldman had a tendency to title a lot of pieces for other people. He wrote for Samuel Beckett, for John Cage, for Christian Wolfe. And he was always a very large influence on me, and so I always wanted to write a piece for him in a certain kind of way. It wasn't about him so much as just thinking about a lot of the compositional ideas that he brought up. And it was sort of ironic because I started writing this piece, and when I was about halfway done with the piece, he died. And it was never meant as a memorial or as a tribute on that level at all, and so I wouldn't listen to it in that way. Is meant much more as a kind of dialogue with certain ideas of his. Harold Budd, again, is one that is very hard to define. We're going to talk about Hal a little later in more detail. But Hal was one of the extreme Fluxus composers in the 60s. He lived in California and did a lot of performance art in those days and very extreme pieces. And then he started doing one of the most avant-garde gestures you could ever do in the late 60s and early 70s. And that was write music that was just absolutely about being very pretty, about being really beautiful. It had tonality, it had chords, it had arpeggios, it had like wind chimes. And at that stage, when he started doing that, and we'll talk about it a little later, it was about the most extremely avant-garde thing you could do in the midst of the Fluxus kind of outpouring at that stage. So this is one of the pieces from the, I think this is what, late 70s, which is a piece that really is intended to be just very beautiful. Stephen Mackey is the youngest composer. He's a contemporary of Todd's. He's in his mid to late 30s. He also teaches at Princeton. It's a shame because on recording, when we selected this, there wasn't very much to choose from, and some of the newer things, I think, are a little more demonstrative of the kind of background of Steve. In some ways, this represents the most probably conservative piece on this tape. Steve's a real interesting one because he was majoring in particle physics in college and had played rock and roll ever since he was a teenager. And when he was about 21 years old, he decided he wanted to learn how to write music and to learn how to read it. He had never even read music before. And he took a music class, and his teacher told him it was much too late for him to start writing music and that he should just give it up. And since that time, he's had a very, very successful career. He finds it ironic because last year he was asked by this teacher who told him never to even become a composer to write a recommendation for him to get a grant. Pauline Oliveris, this is the oldest piece on it. Pauline started the San Francisco Tape Center along with Morton Subotnick, and remember, they were the ones who presented Terry Riley originally. And Pauline is probably one of the very first American women to take a very, very avant-garde stance as a composer. Her music has always been exceptional and never as part of the mainstream at all. And of the women composers I can think of in this country, she's really one of the first to really make a strong stance about that. Most of her music these days tends to be very social, where people get together and she gives them a kind of game where they have a kind of group meditation. The last piece I know that she did, which was a very interesting one, it was in Chicago. You could go into this room and she provided you with synthesizers that you could make sounds with, and you'd make this like a 5-second little piece. And then you got to broadcast it to the moon, and you could choose which crater you wanted sent to. You had a choice of 4 craters. And it would go to the crater and bounce back, and then she would record it for you coming back from the moon, and you would get that as a present at the end of your little experience with it. Your sound that went to the moon and came back, transformed. She's always been that way. The last piece is by Brian Ferneyhough, and the main reason this is on the tape is that Jeff just thinks it's a wonder. I like it too very much. It's a wonderful piece. But Jeff thinks it's an absolutely wonderful piece, and he just couldn't imagine not putting it on the tape. It's a little strange because Brian's a British composer. He's been living in this country since about 1984, but in a way he's not a British composer either. He never really associated himself with England. He spent most of his formative years in Germany and has actually renounced most of his affiliation with English culture. In a certain way, he's very American. He's on his second marriage, both times American. Teaches at University of California at San Diego. And in a sense, has never really associated himself with any geographical place, which makes him very American in some ways. This is a piece for overdubbed bass flutes. A bass flute is like a regular flute, but it's much, much bigger and plays about an octave lower than a traditional flute. And then the last piece on the listening is optional. You don't have to listen to it if you don't want to, because it's a very intense piece. It's a 47-minute piece by Morton Feldman called For Samuel Beckett. He wrote it shortly before he died. It's for an instrumental ensemble of 23 players. And in some ways, it's one of the most extreme of his pieces. If you're willing to go through it, I think it's an absolutely amazing experience, an incredible piece to listen to. One thing about Feldman, which I sense in the piece, and I can't say for sure, but I think that there's a kind of notion somewhere deep in his soul that he is dying, because it's one of the most extreme pieces that he ever wrote. And it's interesting because, very often when a fruit tree is dying, the very last gesture it has is putting out its very sweetest fruit with the biggest seeds, because that's the last thing it can do. And I think in a certain way this piece is a kind of real summing up of everything he believed in at that stage of his life. He died quite young, in his early 60s, colon cancer. The analogy of an orchard, I think, is an interesting one. I've learned an awful lot from growing apples over the years. One of the things that an orchard does, which is what pretty much every generation does, is that an apple orchard, to make itself strong, the roots of the apple tree sends out certain poisons into the soil, which make it difficult for certain other kinds of competitive plants to grow. So it protects itself with this kind of web of a chemical that it puts into the soil. What's ironic about it, and which is so much true of the cultural revolution we've been talking about, is that eventually it puts out so much poison that it kills itself, and apple trees can no longer grow there. But the interesting part about it is, as the apple trees die and as they decay, they create a very fertile soil for the next generation of plants that come up. But the plants that come up cannot be apple trees for the next generation because of this poison in the soil that the apple trees originally put out to protect themselves. And it's ironic when you look at the generations, especially when you start getting into the 70s, how there's extreme rejection of the ideas of John Cage and Milton Babbitt, a kind of almost angriness with their premises, and a feeling that these are no longer valid. And the 70s really evolve in a very, very different way, I think largely because of what happened in the 60s. In the 60s, we have a very unique thing that happened in this culture, and that's that we had some very, very, very strong central causes, especially two or two and a half, let's say. One very strong cause was the civil rights movement. It was a movement that lasted for, 15 years or so, and was a real focus for the whole idea that everyone should have equal rights. The other movement that was extremely strong in the 60s was the anti-war movement, because it was a direct and immediate threat to the very society we were living in. I think the third issue, which evolved a little bit later, but became very strong, was the issue of ecology. The idea that if we don't stop wrecking the world that we're living in, our kids are not going to have anywhere to grow up, or maybe we won't even have kids because it'll be too dangerous an environment. These central causes blurred the categories in the arts a lot. And as I talked about in last week or whenever it was, the category between popular music and so-called classical music became very, very obscure. And both musics became almost more of a political issue than an artistic issue, especially at certain key periods. And rock and roll, especially in the 60s, was much more of a kind of representation of a social value than it was an art form. And I mean, it's very strange to go to a rock and roll concert in the 60s and there would be hundreds of police there. It's strange to go to a concert with hundreds of police surrounding the audience. I remember going to a concert of Janis Joplin, and one of her favorite things to do was to get everyone so excited they would start dancing. And then the police would have to stop the concert because it broke all the fire laws because people were crowding the aisles. So there would be this inevitable sort of buildup of frenzy, and everyone would be leaping out of their chairs and dancing, and then all the lights would go on, and all the police would come out, you know, with their clubs and things, and not necessarily create a violent atmosphere, but definitely create this kind of confrontation, which is what she sought after. And in the same way that people were questioning social values, they were questioning the very values of art. And rock and roll had many and many of the same kinds of expressions that the classical music did at the time. Remember when I played the Velvet Underground for you, the recording was extremely dirty. No attempt made at all to give you a good quality of sound. And that certainly wasn't the case in classical recording at that time. That was the time when this incredible thing came out. I think it was called FFSS, full frequency stereophonic sound. And it was like, you know, this incredibly clean, clear kind of recording possibilities. And the rock movement, as well as many of the classical composers working in Fluxus, chose not to take advantage of it, in fact, to do just the opposite. The same way that many people in the Fluxus movement called themselves composers but had no musical training, many of the popular musicians of that time were similar, like Maureen Tucker in the Velvet Underground really didn't play the drums. She just sat there and pounded the drums. Like Fluxus movement, many of the songs were about social and political issues and very violent often and very unpleasant very often. And also much of the music was very confronting, the same way Lamont Young would play one sound for 3.5 hours so loud you could barely stand it. So many rock bands in those days also played so loud you could just barely get through a concert. And also many of the rock tunes like Fluxus started making these albums that were one thing. You couldn't play tunes anymore. It was a 60-minute piece. You couldn't take extracts anymore from it. So that there was this overlap of the popular and the classical movement at that stage. And I think for the first time, and we'll see it happening in the 70s, I think for the first time in American history, the classical world colored the popular world. Very often in classical music, popular music has colored it. I mean, think of Charles Ives. All the popular music of his day came into his music. But now for the first time, there was this kind of interesting interpenetration. And a lot of the new kinds of categories that came out, which are in-between categories, really work this interpenetration between the popular and classical culture. But that was because there was so much intersection at that stage between the popular and classical culture. But as the 70s come around, this unity of the 60s stops. And the unity of the 60s stops for a multitude of reasons. I won't pretend to know all of them, but I'll give you some of them. For one thing, the revolution had become very scary. It really had become a frightening thing by 1970. I think 1970 was the extreme of it. That was, remember, April 30th is when President Nixon ordered troops into Cambodia, and 80% of the colleges in the United States went on a strike. Well, as I'm sure most of you know, a week later, at Kent State, a rather remarkable thing happened. for the first time in American history, American kids dressed as soldiers went into a college and shot American kids dressed as students. And these were white people killing white people. Before, it was sort of excused because these were race riots or something weird like that. But all of a sudden, for the first time, Americans were killing Americans right here in our own country, and they killed four kids at Kent State and seriously injured four more, as well as injuring others. Less than a week later, and this one isn't so known because it was more suppressed, at Jackson State College in Mississippi, the police shot over 300 bullets into the women's dormitory. It was a black school, and they killed two women and seriously injured many more. So the whole thing was getting really out of hand. But it was, on another level, you couldn't really blame the police because there were, as I say, it was getting very scary, and part of the revolution had factioned itself into these incredibly militant groups. One of the extremely militant groups was a group called the Weathermen, and what they liked to do were bomb buildings, and they killed several people bombing buildings. I remember a riot in New Haven that was a rather extreme one where the Weathermen came dressed in police uniforms and assassinated policemen because the police couldn't tell who was the police and who were the assassins at this stage. Also, the civil rights movement had stopped being a civil rights movement and become an extremely, one faction of it had become extremely militant, the Black Panthers, and they demanded their own country. So the United States was putting its entire like military force in a certain kind of way to stopping the revolution here. In 1969 alone, the police killed 26, I think it was, Black Panthers and arrested 750 of them. So those people who were part of the Love Generation, who wanted peace, were beginning to see the whole thing taking on a turn that was frightening, and frightening in a way that was exhausting and really wanting it to be over. So when in 1973 and 1974 many of the causes started to be over, it became a great relief to stop all of this. In 1973 you had President Nixon removed from office as the president, and this gave the, especially the youth, a kind of feeling that yes, you could do something. If government was corrupt, perhaps you could actually do something about government. And in 1974, the Vietnam War was over, and by then, there were no central causes. One of the things, many things that contributed to the dissipation of the unity of the 60s was now that there was no singular cause like the war, the civil rights movement, you had tons of causes. Millions of causes came up. In terms of human rights, in 1970, the women's movement started. In 1969, the Gay Liberation Front started. You had movements to help the elderly. You had movements to help the handicapped. You had movements to help the American Indians. You had movements to help the consumer. Ralph Nader started appearing. So there were, instead of singular issues, there were many, 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 many issues that dissipated all of it. In terms of the environment, I'm a sucker for environmental issues. I can't believe how many mailing lists I've been on since about that time. There's organizations to save the whales, the bald eagles, the rainforest, industrial waste. I mean, I could probably list at least 20 different organizations now that I get mail from every single month about different environmental issues. So no longer was there this kind of singularity of the 60s. Another thing which is an ironic part of the 60s, and an ironic part of any generation, is that the avant-garde, whether they want to or not, eventually becomes the establishment. And by 1976, John Cage was being performed by the Boston Symphony, the New York Philharmonic, the Los Angeles Philharmonic. He was commissioned to write a piece for the Bicentennial. So in a certain way, the young culture stopped seeing Cage as the leader of the avant-garde and started seeing him as the establishment. Another thing that happened very much, and I mentioned this before in the 70s, is that capitalism bought out the revolution by, in essence, making icons of it, by taking the images of the revolution, like faded blue jeans, long hair, and making them commodities. And I think it's interesting that one thing that was considered on the surface revolutionary, but really wasn't, was the advent in 1975 of punk rock, because punk rock was completely planned. It was completely planned as a commercial thing. Some kid by the name of Johnny Lydon walked into a sex boutique of a real interesting promoter by the name of Malcolm McLaren, and McLaren looked at the kid and he thought, boy, let's change his name to Johnny Rotten and start the Sex Pistols. We'll have this whole new kind of band that's, you know, really rotten, really confronting. But it wasn't like the Velvet Underground or the Fugs that arose out of a social issue. It was because a promoter decided to make this image commercial. And the same way that punk rock was bought out, in a certain way rock and roll became the same thing. It became a commodity which you could package in a beautiful way and you could sell it. It was no longer a revolutionary movement. It was interesting also, that was the time when, in about 1975, when the term designer drugs came out. Instead of, you know, this whole drug revolution of the 60s, now drugs became very special and very expensive, and they all have really fancy names. It wasn't this counterculture anymore. It was all of a sudden a big money-making thing for the society. So the interesting thing is that this unity, which had brought the 60s together, is going to divest itself drastically. And the new culture is going to be quite different. I talked about history a lot as being somehow or another related to certain big metaphors you can use, like Newtonian physics, meaning everything's in the right place, and evolution, meaning that everything evolves from everything else and repetition leaves music at that stage. And then the next big metaphor being relativity, the whole idea that everything is separate from each other. And the extremeness of relativity I talked about as being existentialism in the 50s, where everyone's separate, everyone has their own identity, their own right to be what they are. And Cage is a very good example of this, leaving you alone to hear his music any way you want to. But the next generation's different. The next generation, don't forget, was called the Love Generation, the Flower Children. And there was a desire in this generation now to communicate again, to be part of society. I've related often this whole evolution from the 50s as like a child. And I think if you look at the 50s, the idea of Cage saying, I have nothing to say and I'm saying it, it's like a little kid. It's like purifying music again so that it can be anything it wants to be. It's like a little kid playing with words without any intent, just loving the sound of words. 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence is the extreme of this. Just listen to the sounds around you. Let them be pure sounds. Don't worry about what they are. But the 60s then is the rebellious teenager that says, hey, all your values are wrong and I can communicate and I want to be part of society. And by the time the 70s come around, it's a new generation and the dialectic comes back into music. And ironically enough, what could the avant-garde question except the very premises of the avant-garde itself? This is why Cage gets so negated, and Babbitt and all those composers in the 70s. It's very interesting. I've been teaching since, my first year of teaching was 1969. And until about 1975, especially the ideas of Cage were extremely important to the kids and they always were very interested. By about the mid-70s, through about, I would say about 1985, 86, in a way there was absolutely no interest in his ideas among the younger generation. Very, very little interest. And it's starting to come back again, like all cycles do, like our apple orchard analogy. But coming back in quite a different way, because in the 70s, if we say that the 60s were the rebellious teenager, in the 70s the composer became the young adult that said, hey, I don't want to change society anymore, I just want to be part of it. I want to communicate with you. And if I want to communicate with you, in a certain way, if I want to express myself, what I believe to you, the dialectic has to come back because there's the duality. There's me and there's you and I'm conversing with you. One of the early pieces to do this in a very interesting way was by one of the most rebellious people who I talked about when I talked about minimalism, and that was Frederick Jeffsky, who went here to school. Born in Massachusetts in the late 30s. Incredibly brilliant fellow, incredibly well-trained, went to graduate school at Princeton. And to give you an example of Frederick's kind of political stance and how cantankerous he could be, when he did his, they didn't give a PhD at Princeton, only a master's. And for his master's degree, he played an hour-long serial piece that he composed. Now, Frederick is one of the best improvisers of anyone in the world and an incredible pianist. And after he got his master's degree with honors, he admitted that he made up the whole piece. There was nothing on the pages. He was simply turning blank paper. Now, this didn't make the faculty very happy, and still he has a very difficult time getting any kind of grant or support from older composers because they think of him as very cantankerous. Well, Frederick was one of the people who really did feel that there was a need to renew communication in music. As early as 1966, he wrote, "The music is a search for a new harmony, a process where speaker and listener agree to communicate." Now, but there's still this interesting kind of Cagean side to it, because don't forget, we did come out of the 50s and 60s. Quote, "We are all musicians. We are all creators. Music is a creative process. We can all share, and the closer we come to each other in the process, abandoning esoteric categories and professional elitism, the closer we can all come to the ancient idea of music as a universal language." Well, Frederick became a more or less political exile. He went and lived in Italy because he disagreed so violently with the politics of America in the 60s. Like many composers in that day, he formed his own band. It was called Music Electronica Viva, and they did all these sort of they did concerts practically every week, a group of them, really generally involving audience interaction. They would sometimes ask everyone to bring an instrument and play, and the musicians would be directed to do, like for one piece, try to make everyone sound as good as possible. Do anything you can to make them sound good. And you just get together for 3 hours and see what happened. Well, one of the first really revolutionary things that Frederick did back in 1973 is he started a style which later became called the New Romanticism. He wrote a huge piano piece called The People United Shall Never Be Defeated. And it's based on a very revolutionary anthem from Chile. And it's a set of 36 variations based on this. And it's absolutely direct and tonal and flamboyant and very 19th century. And he came out of probably one of the most avant-garde stances of anyone. He was an extreme Fluxus composer. He did some of the most intensely anti-art kinds of pieces. And then he did the one thing which was one of the most rebellious things you could do, and that's write a very old-fashioned kind of piece. But the piece is wonderful because it goes through, I obviously can't play it, it's an hour long, but I'll play a little bit. But it goes through these 36 variations are sort of like drawers of his mind, and it goes through millions of different styles. It goes through German work songs, and it sounds sort of, sometimes it's 12 tones, sometimes he's just bashing on the piano, sometimes he sings, sometimes he whistles, and the thing ends right before the ending with this improvisation which he does, which is usually about 20 minutes long, where I've seen him do it three times, and twice when he did it, he's so passionate about it that he actually broke a piano string, which is very, very difficult to do. Here's the opening of People United. Music I've been playing for you in the past, isn't it? Especially coming from a composer who is probably considered one of the most avant-garde in the country. In spite of everything, still the piece is highly structural. He uses all of his intelligence, and you could spend a whole course analyzing the piece. Among other things, with the 36 variations, what he did was, I'll just do a little bit of this. He put them in a 6x6 box like this, the numbers, and what he did was he made diagonals. And every variation connected by a diagonal somehow had to be related. He didn't care how, but it had to be related. So you have this whole web of interrelationship happening in the piece. Then he took every sixth variation to somehow sum up the previous variations before it. So every sixth variation becomes a kind of recapitulation of what you've been hearing. So you get this highly composed but highly emotional new kind of style happening called the New Romanticism. Around the same time, what we were talking about as minimalism was also drastically shifting, and you can see it in a piece of Steve Reich called Tehe Lim, which is the first Wind Changes. Tehe Lim means psalm. And when we talked about minimalism before, remember I defined it as process or pattern music because the process of the piece defined the form of the piece. It's T-E-H-I-L-L-I-M, means psalm in Hebrew. For the first time, Steve actually set a text. He set these psalms. And for the first time in his piece, he constructed a form because the text itself dictated a form to him. So the piece no longer was about a process unweaving itself, but now very much like, in a traditional sense, blocks of sound, blocks of a structure that would move from one place to another. And although the actual sound of the piece had the same kind of essence to it that minimal music had at that stage, which was these kind of repeating patterns, pardon me, tonality, strong rhythm, no longer were they functioning as a process which worked through a piece. Now they were simply the material of a piece that was highly composed. Here's what Tehe Lim sounds like a little bit, the very beginning of it. Let's see. It's really difficult to even think of as minimalism anymore. On your second tape, you remember a composer by the name of John Adams, who also went here at Harvard. Well, John's 44 and was highly influenced by Steve Reich's music, has no qualms of admitting that at all, but already he's forgotten. I remember an interview with him recently where they said, "What do you think of Lamont Young?" And he says, "I think nothing about him at all." And he's lost the whole lineage, in a sense, with Cage and Lamont and how that happened, and really evolves out of Steve into a very, very different kind of music. This is the opening, just to give you a sample of the different kind of sound, this is the opening of a piece called Fearful Symmetry for orchestra. Now, John's was very influenced by the fact that his grandfather owned a nightclub that had big bands a lot, and he just loved Duke Ellington. He grew up on Duke Ellington. He was his favorite composer. He listened to him constantly. So you sort of get a cross between Steve Reich and Duke Ellington, but in a very different kind of sound world.
Thank you.
music, haven't they? And the whole idea of a processor phasing now evolving into this style. And actually, Todd Machover, many people consider sort of the extension of that, the next generation of what you would do if you were essentially John Adams 10 years younger. The last category, other categories emerge out of this. One is performance art, which we won't get into too much today. But the last category I'd like to talk about is what Harold Budd did, which is essentially a little bit like Frederick, but done in a much more extreme way. And this was the idea of writing really, really pretty music that I talked about at the very beginning of class. Hal was also associated as one of the most extreme composers of the avant-garde. He performed with a group in California called the California Time Machine, and that was the group that did the piece that put hydrogen peroxide in people's ears so you could hear your earwax burning and think about dying children in Vietnam. And he would do pieces where he'd just roll on a gong for like 18 hours straight sitting under a blue light. Well, late 60s, he decided, I'm going to write really, really pretty music. I'm going to write tonal, pretty, gorgeous music. And this music, he's not the only one who did it, but this music has had a tremendous influence on the pop scene because, among other things, Brian Eno took a great interest in Hal Budd early on. And Brian Eno invented a term he later called ambient music, or this music that could be sort of fill a room like a perfume and fill a room with beautiful sounds. And this eventually became what we call now New Age music. At that stage, it was quite a different thing. Let me play a little bit of one of his first pieces in this new style, a piece called Juno. Very different kind of music than we've been hearing. So I think what happened in the 60s, in a sense, is the metaphor of relativity stopped, existentialism stopped. The new generation wanted some sort of unity. I don't know what the new metaphor is yet. I think it's hard to pardon me, look back on it enough to say. In science, you find all sorts of things like this attempt for the grand unified theory. Sorry, I got chalk in my throat. Or the new superstring theory, which is also a much more holistic kind of approach. And I think what you see now also with this music and what we'll end with next time is a real desire among the young generation to communicate. And if there was a message that was handed down from Cage that was listened to, it is the fact that you are allowed to be any person you want to be. And hey, it's not wrong to want to communicate, is it? Is it wrong to want to be popular? Is it wrong for other people to want to like your music? If that's how you sincerely are, let's take that premise and let's go from there. And next class, we'll sort of look at the music that evolves in the mid-70s and into the 80s, and I'll try to more or less sum things up. So, see you next time.